Truthspresso, episode 22.
Face it, we all would rather sleep in this morning. That's why God gave us espresso, to kickstart our zombified corpses into hyperdrive. And now, giving your mind and soul the morning shot of truth it craves. This is Truthspresso with Daniel Minnick.
What does it mean for humans to be equal? What does it mean for all of us to be equal? If you search Google News, you will be inundated with articles about political campaigns for equality. You know, things like gender equality, racial equality, ethnic equality, transgender equality, marriage equality, etc. Hi, my name is Daniel Minnick, and welcome to Truthspresso. If this is the first episode of Truthspresso that you are listening to, I would sincerely invite you to check out all that Truthspresso has to offer in the archives. In fact, this episode could be considered a general segue from episodes 17 and 18 that talked about the gender pay gap, and so I would highly recommend, of course, that you listen to those episodes as well and get a little bit of a background as to where I may be coming from with this episode. There are all kinds of gaps that are allegedly need to be closed. For instance, the gender wage gap that I just mentioned. This is the idea that men and women on average should be earning the same salary on average. The statistics in lots of articles that you can see show that women on average, when you average all women earning and working so-called full-time hours, they earn roughly 80% around there, the total amount of earnings that men on average in all sectors working so-called full-time hours work. There are also other gaps. The so-called racial wage gap, in which people of varying ethnicities, you know, so-called white people and so-called black people, African Americans, Europeans, Caucasians, Asians, Hispanics, somehow there's a problem because if we average up all the earnings that Hispanics on average make versus whites and versus blacks and versus Asians, on average, there is a disparity. And politically speaking, that's a gap that needs to be bridged. It needs to be closed. Another gap is the mental health care gap. Another gap, the prosecution empathy gap. And what about the generation gap? How about this one? The urban-rural poverty gap. There's also a retirement gap. There is the education gap. There's the idea that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. Are all these true? Even if there's some truth in its own right, what are the goals being espoused? Are these goals something that needs to be accomplished? And at what cost? With what resources do we try to make people equal in certain regards? Of course, in all the political discourse, rarely do I discover articles talking about one particular gap that never seems to be addressed by the powers that be, who rob the fruits of our labor by coercive taxation. And this gap is the gap between tax revenues and spending, also known as a deficit. So why don't we have the political pressures to close that gap, mind you? I believe it's long past due for the spendthrifts in government who do nothing productive in and of themselves to earn the money that they rob from us to mind the gap when it comes to deficit spending. So we hear lots of political talk about closing this or that gap based on gender and so-called race and so-called the generation and about how to make sure everyone has the same retirement, everyone has the same education, and how that there's social injustice between the fact that there are rich people and poor people, and some people get richer and some people allegedly get poorer. So it's just assumed that equality in whatever X and Y variables are put on the pendulum is some kind of desired goal. I mean, equality is a nice word. There are certain ways in which we as human beings should be considered equal. As humans, we're not animals, we're not worms. I mean, do we need to bridge the human bird gap or the human worm gap or the human amoeba gap? I mean, we recognize that there's something intrinsic to being human that warrants a certain type of equality. And so my mission in this episode and the next episode is to really deal with this idea of equality and really try to figure out just in what ways should we strive to be equal and in what ways is it okay and to be unequal. In fact, are there severe ramifications for trying to force certain types of so-called equality onto society when the normal bent, the exercise of individual freedom would actually tend to utilize the inequality that exists in people? But when you give people political power and their political might depends on votes and they want to appeal to the masses, then this idea of equality is a very powerful incentive to get people to vote for certain campaigns, and equality seems to be a very noble goal. But how do we define where we should promote equality? If we could always figure out any kind of difference, here's an X on the left side, here's a Y on the right side, is there a gap to bridge between anything that's different? Because somehow differences promote inequality, and inequality is this big boogeyman that needs to be removed from our nightmares. It's this big dragon that needs to be slain. And once we finally conquer the unequal distribution of whatever, wealth, gifts and talents and so on, do we finally achieve a human utopia? Well, we should know, we could intuitively recognize that not all goals for equality between all given X and Y would make sense. Let's consider this. We talked about the gender wage gap in episodes 17 and 18, as I mentioned before. If men on average earn more than women on average, you have an X and a Y right there. Men versus women. The X and the Y are two different genders. But let's do a little thought experiment here. Let's talk about the age inequality. Let's talk about an age wage gap. Hey, it's pretty cool that age and wage rhyme. Ahem. Okay, the age inequality gap. Do some people earn more because they're older than some people earn because they're younger? So what about an age gap, an age wage gap between 5-year-olds and 25-year-olds? I mean, if you average up all the earnings of 25-year-olds, whether male or female, and compare that to the average earnings of all 5-year-olds, whether male or female, you're going to come up with quite a disparity. I mean, the average of earnings of all 5-year-olds would be pretty much zero unless you account for some parents might give their children little bits of money here and there called allowance. And some, you know, some wealthy parents might give their children more of an allowance than other parents might. And even some parents who don't give their children allowance, they're certainly giving them food and clothing and shelter and Christmas presents and all kinds of other things that are not in liquid form. Or they're not, I don't mean water, I mean liquidity, money. So we recognize that an age wage gap between 5-year-olds and 25-year-olds is not a good comparison here. What about between 25-year-olds and 95-year-olds? Well, some 95-year-olds might still be working. Some people don't reach the age of 95, but the ones that do exist, the ones that do living, there might be some that are actually working in some form. You know, there are some pretty amazing 95-year-olds out there. So if you average the average earnings between male and female 25-year-olds and male and female 95-year-olds, I would bet that minus, you know, some wealthy 95-year-olds, if you consider retirement income, the 25-year-olds just might be earning more than the 95-year-olds. And how about the 25-year-olds and, say, 50-year-olds? Well, if you look at those statistics, the 50-year-olds are likely to be earning more than the 25-year-olds. Why? I mean, 25-year-olds are much more able-bodied. So for the 25-year-olds that do professional sports, which is a relatively small segment of 25-year-olds, the ones that do professional sports might actually earn more than the average 50-year-old. But when you account for the laws of averages and recognizing a lot of 25-year-olds are just starting their careers out, a lot of them just graduated from college and they're still trying to figure out how to make money in this dog-eat-dog world, and you compare that with an established 50-year-old who has been working a career, who has been advancing and has been earning raises, then the 50-year-olds, on average, are going to beat the 25-year-olds. Now, why shouldn't we cry foul about that? What about bridging the age-wage gap between the 25-year-olds and the 50-year-olds? Well, when we think about it, there are certain factors that would kind of destroy the economy a little bit if you try to force the earnings of 25-year-olds on average to be the same as 50-year-olds. Either you'd have to reduce the earnings of the 50-year-olds to come down to the 25-year-olds, which would disincentivize the 50-year-olds trying to save up for their retirement or building inheritance for their children, and the 25-year-olds, if you were to raise the wages of the 25-year-olds to make them on par with the earnings of established and seasoned 50-year-olds who have gone up the corporate ladder in their careers and earned raises with work experience, now you would see the injustice with that. 25-year-olds might like that, but the 50-year-olds would not. So we recognize that there needs to be some way to advance in your life, and there needs to be a way to allow the 25-year-olds the time to achieve the parity of the 50-year-olds. So bridging that age-wage gap would be political suicide and destructive to the economy. Of course, anyone proposing such an absurd concept, as I mentioned, with the 5-year-old and 25-year-old age-wage gap would be accused of supporting child labor, understandably. There's no reason that we would have an age-wage gap. I mean, I just picked an X and a Y there to show that not all things, not all distinctions, when you compare averages that could be presented as some form of gap, you can recognize that that is not necessarily something that needs to be bridged or closed. Let's think of another type of gap. What about the height gap? Well, on average, men are taller and stronger than women. Now, of course, I know, you can always point out exceptions. I mean, I'm actually familiar with a young lady who went to a church I used to go to, and she went to college, and I believe from pictures I'd see as I scroll through my Facebook posts, she was on a weightlifting team or something like that. She was doing powerlifting, and she is probably much physically stronger than I am, could probably lift heavier weights than I can. But, you know, so there could always be exceptions to the averages, but you can't dispute the idea by pointing out exceptions that there isn't a rule. And the rule that I'm saying is that on average, men are taller and stronger than women. That's a genetic, biological fact. We just talked about the height gap between men and women, and we might want to ask the question, how do we bridge that gap? I mean, it could be technically possible to bridge that gap if we did some serious form of ethnic cleansing and we, you know, prevented taller men from reproducing and we prevented shorter women from reproducing and we forced men, you know, shorter men and averagely shorter men and average taller women to be the only ones allowed to reproduce. That might do something to somewhat bridge the gap, but we'd realize we'd lose a lot of useful skills. I mean, height and strength can come in handy, can't it? So we'd recognize trying to bridge that kind of gap would eliminate a lot of potential talent and a lot of potential productivity. Now, what about the height gap based on various nationalities and ethnicities? The average height of men in the Netherlands is 9 inches taller than the average height of men in Indonesia. Do we need to bridge that height gap? I mean, isn't it unfair? If height is an advantage, isn't it unfair that Netherlanders should be, you know, likely to be taller than Indonesians? Well, you know, it doesn't seem to be a problem for Indonesians that, you know, they can make do with the resources that they have, and, you know, they don't may not necessarily have to do things that require a lot of height. But if they did need taller people to help out with certain things, they can just call up their friends in the Netherlands and have them help with that. But, you know, you get the point. How would we bridge this height gap between Netherlands and Indonesia? Is that really a laudable goal? And would it have problems in the economy? When thinking about this, a verse comes to mind. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, was teaching his disciples some important concepts. He talked about charity. He talked about the poor in spirit. He talked about enduring persecution. But he talked about not taking thought for tomorrow and really being content with food and raiment, being content with what you have. You know, Jesus didn't really tell people to solve social injustices about, you know, wage gaps between men and women and, you know, height gaps and what and ethnicity gaps and what have you. But he did say this one verse that did come to mind when talking about this height gap. Matthew 6:27, from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, he asks his disciples this question: which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit unto his stature? We have surgical methods in today's technology that can do prosthetics. You know, you can actually increase people's heights in different artificial ways. But Jesus was really asking the question, which of you by taking thought can add one cubit to his stature? You know, like some people might be envious of other people. I mean, I know I, as a kid, would be envious of taller people, especially when I'd want to play basketball. I was never good at it, but, you know, whenever I'd be playing basketball with friends and, you know, I had some friends that were over 6 feet tall and they can jump up and grab the rim, and I, being my measly sub 6 foot tall self, you know, fully grown, I'm now 5'8", but by taking thought, I cannot add a cubit to my stature so that I can be a better basketball player. I mean, I appreciate the way God made me, and I've never once been able to jump up, even when I was in the peak of my physical performance in my 20s, and I was, you know, very athletic, and I played volleyball and in a city league and, you know, at a recreation center, and I have never known athleticism like I did then. I was able to jump pretty high playing volleyball, and being only 5'8", I could jump up about, you know, 3/4 of the way up to the rim. But never once in my life have I ever been able to jump up. I'd run as hard as I could, jump as high as I could, but, you know, my physical limitations, I simply could never jump up and touch that rim. And now, as I am nearly 40 years old, it might be possible if I were really to push myself and pretty much devote my entire life to doing nothing but trying to work on my physical health and train my body, you know, like a basketball player, and try to jump up and grab that rim. Well, even if that were remotely possible, it just would not be feasible. I mean, I'm a husband. I have a wife and I have 4 kids, and it would be ridiculous even if I had such a desire, which, you know, I will say I don't care, you know, I don't have to jump up and touch that rim to be fulfilled in life. I have much more productive things to do with my life and take care of my family, and it would not be good for me to ignore my family duties and focus on some kind of self-centered activity to try to jump up and touch a rim. So we can see that there is diversity. There's diversity in gender, which there are only 2, by the way. There is diversity in height. Let's really consider the ethnic diversity that we experience in professional sports. Should we strive politically for ethnic equality in professional sports? To answer this question, I went to a website, I went to an article called "In an Ethnic Breakdown of Sports, NBA Takes Lead for Most Diverse." This is from globalsportsmatters.com. This is from 2018, December 12th, and I will post a link to this article in the show notes. According to the article, the Major League Baseball has 1/4 of its top players as African American or Latino. So that's kind of a lower statistic. It seems that Major League Baseball has for quite a while been dominated by what would be considered Caucasian white males. But African Americans and Latinos in total for the roster make up over 42% of the players. So out of 42% of the players, they're only about 25% of the top players. Should we consider this social injustice? Is this ethnic inequality? Do we need to bridge this gap? Do we need to close the gap in Major League Baseball between Caucasian white star players and African American or Latino star players? One thing about baseball is that among several of the well-known professional sports, baseball is not as physically demanding. I mean, you do have your running, you need to be able to swing that bat and hit the ball, you know, hitting a home run requires a decent amount of strength and practice. And being able to run and slide, that requires some level of physicality. But it's relatively speaking, baseball is simply not as physically demanding as other sports. Now, there's a little more logistical skills than just sheer physical prowess. So that's Major League Baseball. Most of the stars in Major League Baseball are white Caucasians. Now, let's jump over to the NBA. According to this article from GlobalSportsMatters.com, over four-fifths of the roster in the NBA are what are called colored people. That would include Latinos, but among these four-fifths of the players, most of them are African-American. Why? Is it because the owners of the NBA teams are ethnically biased in favor of African-Americans? Well, maybe, but, you know, like Major League Baseball, the owners simply hire players that have the physical makeup, the talent, and the training for the sport. That just happens to favor African Americans overwhelmingly. The Asian players are a fraction of a percent, which is barely a blip on the radar. Now let's look at a particular player that's kind of taken the NBA by storm. Remember, if, you know, I'm kind of dating myself here a little bit, but you know, I'm sure most Americans have heard of Michael Jordan. Yeah, Michael Jordan pretty much defined basketball in the late 20th century. But LeBron James has taken the position from Michael Jordan as being the face of basketball for the early 21st century. He's pretty much the new Michael Jordan. He has height on Michael Jordan by, I believe, 3 inches, and he has physical characteristics that matter for the best performance of the sport. Should we cry foul that we need more Asians represented in basketball? Of course, I'm not suggesting that there aren't really good Asian players. This is not to say that there aren't some incredible Asian Americans in the NBA, like Jeremy Lin, but the supply of highly qualified Asians is dwarfed by the supply of highly qualified and taller African American players. So what about bridging this ethnic inequality here represented in major sports? Why is it that Major League Baseball seems to be biased toward Caucasian whites, and the NBA seems to be biased largely toward African Americans? Is it because of characteristics, physical, genetic makeup that helps the law of averages to hover more towards certain ethnicities for certen activities? Now, it's not to say that basketball can only be African American and baseball can only be white Caucasian. Obviously, that's not what I'm talking about, and that's not the truth. It's just that there are that the supply curve is different for each of those. Just like when I think about economics professors, really, there are a lot more white and even Asian economics professors than there are, you know, African American economics professors. But we've, you know, a lot of us have heard of Thomas Sowell. Thomas Sowell is brilliant as an economist. I mean, I would put Thomas Sowell up against someone like Paul Krugman any day. And Thomas Sowell is actually he's a very conservative economist. And there might be more You know, when it comes to something like brain surgeons, there might be proportionally more Asians or, you know, even people from India. There's probably a lot more Indian brain surgeons than there are African Americans. But we might be familiar with one particular African American brain surgeon by the name of Ben Carson. Now, compared to a lot of, you know, his fellow African Americans, and even toward people of other ethnicities, Ben Carson is brilliant. Think about this. Brain surgery is one of the most demanding, one of the most intellectual areas of the medical profession ever. And Ben Carson is an African American brain surgeon. Now, going back to sports, we just asked the question about Asians and the NBA and how Asians represent about, you know, 0.2% of the roster on the NBA. Does that say Asians are, you know, not good at sports? I mean, there's relatively fewer Asians in football, you know, American football and baseball in America than there are whites and blacks. But you will see a lot more Asians represented in other sports, such as ping pong. That's quite an Asian-dominated sport. Soccer, or I know, it's called football, right? Yes, that's the proper term, but because we have football in America, we're going to call it soccer. Soccer actually is pretty ethnically diverse, but, you know, you're going to see a lot more Asians in soccer than you will in American football, where you have to have certain large body build, and height certainly is a good thing to have in football too, or in basketball, where there are relatively fewer Asians that are 7 feet tall compared to the supply of African Americans who are 7 feet tall. Other sports that have a lot more Asians, I said ping pong and soccer, there's also badminton, and especially a big one is gymnastics. You know, Asians, on average, are going to be in sports in which being nimble, having high endurance, and having a keen understanding of the laws of physics allow them to excel in, you know, what I would consider breathtaking feats of wizardry. You know, you watch Asians perform in some of these sports, and it's like your jaw drops and your eyes are bugged out watching it, you know, and especially think of things like various martial arts, like Chinese Kung Fu. You know, if you're going to watch the movies about martial arts, most of them are Asians for good reason. A lot of them, you know, they invented a lot of these martial arts and they introduced them to America. And the average Asian is going to be a lot better, you know, a lot more mobile, a lot more flexible, a lot more disciplined, and just have a certain makeup in their body that's able to do certain types of acrobatics and kicks and so on than other people. You know, and of course, it's not to say that you don't have amazing people of other ethnicities that learn and discipline themselves and do some amazing martial arts, but there are a lot more Asians doing a lot more amazing martial arts than there are represented by other ethnicities. So if we try to force sports to practice affirmative action, we will see fewer dunks in the NBA, fewer touchdowns in the NFL, fewer home runs in the Major League Baseball, and we would see fewer amazing backspin drives in ping pong, and, you know, you get the idea. Let people's skills fall where they may. Let people be free to use the way God has designed their bodies, and let people be free to pursue discipline and learning their skills and demonstrating their skills as they fall. Let's not try to force some kind of quota system in every sport. Think about this. The Olympics would become much less impressive and much less entertaining If those with the discipline and the skills to accompany their unique physical attributes were not allowed to compete because they had to be replaced by less capable persons, all because every sport, every event, every activity, every medal had to have an equal representation of various ethnicities. And for that matter, just how granular would we really need to go when representing what we would consider a distinct ethnicity? Let's forget white, black, Hispanic, and Asian, or Pacific Islander, or whatever have you. What about Irish, Gaelic, Scottish, and Welsh American? How about Croatian, Slavic, Albanian, and Ukrainian American? And what about Ugandan and Nigerian, Egyptian, and Kenyan American? Not to mention various tribes within African nations. Now, here's an example that really brings home what I'm trying to get at here with ethnic diversity and the beauty of it all. For example, did you know that the African country of Kenya produces the world's greatest marathon runners of all time? In fact, it's not just if someone's from Kenya, but if someone is from the Kalenjin tribe in Kenya. Now, I read this article entitled "How One Kenyan Tribe Produces the World's Best Runners." This is an NPR article. The article mentions that David Epstein, senior editor of Sports Illustrated, was investigating the amazing phenomenon about Kenyan runners, particularly those of the Kalenjin tribe. He was investigating this while writing a book entitled "The Sports Gene." According to the NPR article, Epstein dared to investigate, quote, "a more controversial line of inquiry," unquote, which was if there are any unique genetic features inherent in the Kalenjin tribe that bias them toward faster, longer running ability. To quote from the article, quote, "Asking that question almost convinced Epstein to back out of his book contract. He realized he'd have to address sensitive questions of ethnic and racial differences. Academics told him that they had evidence of genetic advantage but wouldn't share their research with him for fear they'd lose their jobs," unquote. Why? Why is the culture of academia so idealistic that truth and science would be called controversial? Because it doesn't fit the idea of closing gaps. It doesn't fit the idea of bridging gaps and eliminating unfairness. They want, you know, it doesn't fit with the idea of creating the conceptual vanilla human being and smoothing out unfair advantages. It seems to me that academia wants to lecture us about why we all somehow can't embrace diversity enough, so-called, while at the same time they fight to suppress the actual differences that diversity would represent. To get back and summarize the article points out that some scientists informed Epstein that the thinner shape of the legs and ankles allow the Kalenjin Kenyans to displace their weight and move faster while also preserving more energy for endurance. You don't say. You mean like how being taller makes it easier to dunk a basketball? I am reminded of 1 Corinthians 4:7, where the Apostle Paul writes down, "For who maketh thee to differ from another?" My friend, who makes you to differ from another? If God is the one who, by creating us and designing us, makes us differ from one another, then the differences that we possess can be a good thing. Some people are better at basketball than others. Some people are better at football or baseball or hockey than others. Some people have natural talents. Some people have to try harder at certain things. Some people are better at singing than others. Some people are even have a better metabolism than others. Some people are men. Other people are women. Men are different from women. Women are different from men. Men are different from other men. Women are different from other women. Women have, on average, can have certain skills and have certain abilities to do things that men can't, and vice versa. But we should all be able to help each other out and help society out by using the way God has created us to take care of each other, and not necessarily to bridge some gap and to create some form of equality that would iron out the wrinkles and would trim off the extremities of skills, positive skills, talents, just for the sake of bridging a gap. My friend, I urge you to consider the way God has made you and to fulfill the purpose that you could see in the way you have been uniquely designed, and not to think that the differences you have with someone else, whether it be defined by gender or skin color or physical makeup or talents, be some kind of social injustice that is imposed on you by other human beings, and that somehow you need some kind of law from Congress or what have you, the government, to force other people to do without so that you can be made equal. Because when we're all made equal, we're all worse off. And when we allow our inequalities to thrive, we make society more vibrant and more productive, and that helps out our fellow human being.
Thank you for waking up with Truth Espresso. Good morning, and God bless your day.
Hey friends, Daniel Minnick here again. If you liked waking up to this episode of Truth Espresso, I would really appreciate it if you would rate it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or whatever application you use to listen to Truth Espresso.